Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you. Today, animal therapy reduces anxiety and loneliness in college students, Georgia State University. And a study shows that medications, the frequently given medications, are incorrectly given to children, Nationwide Children's Hospital. Autism Bomb, Bayer herbicide causes autism, even at trace levels, Natural Society. Herbs to fight colds, flu, and chronic disease, and much more coming at you. Then from our public health segment, as vaccination rates go up, so does infant death. Could injecting newborns with toxic chemicals be behind the sudden infant death syndrome? Ethan Huff, Natural News. Also today, from our environmental segment, 500 more dead sea lions. Fukushima radiation continues to spread across the ocean. Jonathan Benson. Then, Obama's paramilitary police, the war on terror, comes home. And then, following up yesterday on minimalism, where two individuals found that even though they had worked hard and were successful, they were miserable. Their success, their materialism, their focus upon having more stuff cost them marriages, friendships, their health. They were on drugs, they were drinking, they were a mess. And then they turned it all around. So today, a 35-minute discussion on consumerism, what many, myself included, consider the most dangerous ism we're facing today. It will do us in quicker than all the others. And also today, I'll be sharing what I consider a progressive series of reforms that any and all candidates for any and all offices around the United States in the future could use to get the people once again involved, to really do things that involve we the people. And I'll share those with you as well. We know that we have an epidemic in autism. We know that young boys, now it's 1 in 50, and probably at the rate we're going will be 1 in 30. They say it's genetic. There is no genetic epidemic in history. They say that it has nothing to do with vaccines. And yet, their own vaccine injury court has awarded hundreds of millions of dollars to more than 84 individuals who have proven scientifically and medically that their autism and brain injuries were due to vaccinations. They, at the FDA, say vaccines are safe, that mercury is safe, that aluminum adjuvants are safe, formaldehyde is safe. The other agency of government, the National Cancer Institute, says these are all known carcinogens and neurotoxic in any amount. So you see the contradictions from our own official agencies. Now we can look at the article published in Frontiers of Behavioral Neuroscience, a major journal. And it talks about Bayer's link with GMO crops. Remember, Bayer, along with Monsanto, Syngenta, are at the top of the food pyramid when it comes to creating these genetically modified crops. And Bayer's Liberty Link GMO crops made to withstand the GLA herbicide are linked directly to autism-like symptoms, according to a new study. even in low doses. Both pre- and postnatal exposure to GLA caused symptoms in laboratory mice. Pointing to the findings of previous research linking herbicides and autism, as well as with Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, the study explains that pesticide and herbicide exposure weakens the basic structure of the brain. The developmental impact of GLA, which is a glufosinate ammonium, and it's extremely toxic, causes all this damage. This is from the study. Quote, significant effects of GLA, that's the pesticide, maternal exposure on early reflex development, pup communications, affiliate behaviors, and preference for social olfactory cues, both emotional reactivity and emotional memory remained unaltered. These behavioral alterations showed a striking resemblance to changes seen in animal models of autistic spectrum disorder. At the brain level, GLA, maternal exposure, causes some increase in relative brain weight in the offspring. In addition, reduced expression of PTEN and PEG3, two genes implicated in autism-like defects, was observed in the brain of GLA-exposed pups at postnatal day 15. Our work thus provides new data on the link between pre- and postnatal exposure to the herbicide GLA and the onset of autism-like symptoms later in life. So, there we have it. And by the way, there's some brand new research from the Institute of Responsible Technology showing that cannabis oil was able to show promise in treating autism. I'll be doing more on that with the scientists involved in the near future. So remember, these herbicides, these pesticides that have been used for a long time are dangerous. But now let's do something very positive. Let's talk about what can help us. And I'm going to keep it simple because this morning when I was getting a very powerful juice for the day, because I've got a long day and long night tonight, world premiere of my new films tonight, so I have to be in highly energized form. So a person walks up to me and says, I don't want to get a cold or flu that I get every year for the past 25 years, but I want something that's simple. What do you suggest? And so I gave him my opinion that I believe that it's not turmeric, but rather it's the active ingredient in turmeric, curcumin, and the curcuminoids, the actual oils, that will make a difference, generally at 1,000 milligrams, because curcumin regulates tumor suppressor pathways and triggers mitochondria-mediated death in the cancer tissue. That's good. It's also anti-angiogenic, which means that it shuts down the ability of cancer cells to develop the extra blood supply that they need to fuel the cancer. That's good. And that also the curcumin is probably the single most studied herb to help the immune system in nature. The curcuminoid compounds boost levels of the body's most potent antioxidants, including glutathione, superoxide dismutase, and catalase. And those three natural molecules are critical for you having damage reduced from stress. And a lot of people, when they're under stress, they come down with colds and flu. And so that's one of the most powerful things you can do for your immune system, and it's anti-inflammatory to boot. And if you took that with some coconut oil in a smoothie, that would just be terrific. But I would add something to it, and that would be green tea, because green tea also is rich in polyphenol, antioxidants. And if you read the article in antiviral research, it showed that EGCG, the active ingredients in green tea, inhibits the flu virus from replicating in cell culture. In fact, scientists found that it blocks the hemagglutinin enzyme in the virus, which inhibits its ability to infect other cells. It also suppresses viral RNA synthesis by altering key properties of the viral cell membrane. And it also green tea and the active ingredient in green tea, ECGC, has been shown to suppress pathogenic viruses like Epstein-Barr virus, herpes, HIV-1, and the influenza virus. And it also contains high levels of L-theanine, which has been shown to activate human gamma delta T lymphocytes to proliferate and make interferon, gamma IG. And IFG is a potent antimicrobial cytokine that is the first line of defense in the bloodstream against infection. And also, green tea contains small amounts of what are called alkylamines, which are also present in pathogenic organisms. And so when you drink green tea, the alkylamines present act as relatively weak antigens that don't fully activate the immune system, but get it ready to start. So every time you have green tea, in effect, you're kind of turning on the engine. Now, that's a little bit of science mixed in there, and that's because so many people watching, listening right now are nurses, physicians, professors, public health officials, and they always like to know that there is legitimate good science behind common sense advice. So for the layperson, there's the common sense and the takeaway, you know, the basic message. And for those who want to know, does this come from a peer-reviewed journal? Is this based upon good science? The answer is always yes, and that's why I cite it. And also on this issue, a lot of people want to improve their digestive health. Now, there are a lot of things that are causing you to have poor digestion, including overeating, simply too much food, having a cold beverage with a meal frequently suspends digestion because it upsets the internal biochemistry and the homeostasis of the heat acid alkaline balance in the stomach. Ideally, the stomach should have is going to be acidic, but it also doesn't want to be too acidic, because then you end up burning the actual cells and go right through the mucosal membrane. And you don't want it to be too little and acidic, like if you ate bad food and then took an antacid, you're not going to have any digestion, so to speak. And a lot of partially digested material from those barbecued ribs and other things are going to go right into your intestine, and then that's going to cause a problem, because that's going to congeal in there. It'll coalesce into a bulk material, and that causes constipation, hard-impacted stools. You want it to go through smoothly. You want the nutrients to be absorbed, so you don't want big, chunky pieces of food. You want it almost like like a tomato soup consistency. That's ideal. But that means you have to take your time eating. You can't rush. You can't chew one, chew twice, and swallow. Mastication is important. You don't want to eat and start working out or rushing, because then the body gets two signals simultaneously, and it confuses it. Should I be digesting this food, which requires you to be relaxed, or do I want to put energy into the mitochondria in your muscles because you're moving? So the body will go towards the moving and slow down, even suspend, if you're highly anxious, digestion. Just think of an animal in the wild, a wildebeest grazing, alert but not stressed. And then suddenly the wildebeest picks up the smell of the lion and starts to get ready to bolt, or does. All digestion stops. All the energy through the flight or fight response is put into the musculature. And so frequently they just vacate their bowels. Everything comes out because nature wants them to have whatever they need to stay alive. So what happens when you're talking on the phone and you're angry about something, or you're hearing someone else is yelling at you, or you're faced with a stressful situation? Do you really think at that moment you're going to have good digestion? You will not. No one can have good digestion when they're stressed. You need to be de-stressed in order to digest your food and to get proper digestion, assimilation, utilization, and elimination. Just the basics are being missed in our society, and you don't have to be a scientist to appreciate that. So let's just say that we start to take more time to eat. We don't watch the news, which is very stressful. We're not arguing with someone. Instead, we're eating in peace and harmony. which, by the way, is one of the reasons that all of my retreats, everyone eats in silence, because then they're able to be de-stressed and focus upon the quality and energy of the food. So what can we do to help ourselves? Well, there's several things that help digestion. One is apple cider vinegar. That's made from fermenting apples. And it is great because it helps our digestion. It introduces beneficial enzymes and probiotics, amino acids, to improve your digestion, to eliminate heartburn, to stimulate lymphatic system, to help get rid of candida, to strengthen your immune system. It does all that. And it'll also strengthen the pH of your stomach acid. Chia seeds. Chia seeds do not have to be chewed up in order to release their healing nutrients, as does flaxseed or sunflower or pumpkin seeds. The moment they are put into the presence of any liquid, there's hydrolyzing of the skin, and it gels and becomes this very easy to digest. But it's great in your digestive system because it can pick up 10 times its weight in water and cleanse that out. There's also prebiotics, the good gut-friendly probiotics. Fermented vegetables are also good. If you're having some problems with digestion, have a glass of cabbage juice. Have a glass of sauerkraut juice. That will certainly make a difference. Aloe vera, of course, is the superstar. Aloe is the best of the best of the best. Irritable bowel syndrome, ulcers, Crohn's disease, colitis, aloe vera. Helping with candida and parasites, aloe vera. Relieving constipation, aloe vera. Reducing and reversing acidic reflux, aloe vera. Those are the things that can make a difference. Now, to another segment, our environmental segment. Another mysterious wave of dead sea animals has washed ashore in Peru. And according to Jonathan Benson of Natural News, this may be due to the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility in Japan. The BBC reported on it, and this is about 250 miles north of the capital, which is Lima, Peru, and there was no explanation. Well, you don't have massive, otherwise healthy sea life die-offs unless there's something there, but we've had hundreds of thousands of these larger mammals dying off in the last 3 years since Fukushima. We did not have this in these amounts before. And billions of fish dying off. We didn't have that unless there was some form of contamination. But you see, every single day, more than 100,000 gallons of toxic radioactive water is going right in the Pacific and has all this time. So we should be paying attention to this. I had Arne Gunderson on this program, and he talked about how we are now seeing all of this dead sea life. It's coming ashore. It's here. And the government will stay in denial because think of what that would do to the economy of California. First off, think what it would do to the real estate value of all those homes perched up and down the coast, multi-million-dollar homes. That would devalue them. After all, if something is killing walruses, sea lions, seals, porpoises, do you really think people are going to want to go in the water? No. People are not that foolish. Most people are not. Then how long does it take for that which is polluting the water to also end up in the air, polluting the land? Then you have a collapse in your real estate market. You have a collapse in your tax base. You have a collapse in the food system up and down the coast of California, from Alaska down. And it's a disaster. So they've got to stay in denial mode. Next up, this is from Ethan Huff. Quote, evidence continues to mount that points to vaccines as the mystery trigger behind sudden infant death syndrome. A recent study published in the journal Attica as well as extensive data on vaccination rates and the timing of the sudden infant death cases suggest that vaccines may be inhibiting the proper development of the hippocampus in some babies, resulting in various breathing and cardiac failures that lead to sudden infant death syndrome. Researchers from Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School inadvertently discovered this after observing that nearly half of all infants in a group who died from sudden infant death syndrome had a unique abnormality in their hippocampus that was not present in infants who died from other known causes. Based on their observations, it is now believed that this abnormality upsets the brain's ability to regulate breathing and heart rate patterns during sleep, which is when sudden infant death syndrome typically occurs. Though it is widely known that the hippocampus regulates brain-specific functions like memory, learning, and spatial orientation, this central region of the brain also regulates breathing and cardiac function. So when a structure within the hippocampus, known as the dentate gyrus, contains double layers of nerve cells instead of the usual single layers, the resulting abnormality, known as focal granular cell, can lead to sudden death for reasons that may not be initially apparent. Quote, the pattern of abnormal changes in the dentate gyrus suggests to us there was a problem in its development at some point in late fetal life or in the months right after birth. And that was from Dr. Kinney, medical doctor, lead author of the study. Quote, we didn't see any signs of injury to the brain by low oxygen levels in the tissues we examined, such as scarring and loss of nerve cells. So, that was a study funded by the National Institutes of Health. Now, how this relates to vaccines was explained in a study published in the journal Human and Experimental Toxicology. Since sudden infant death syndrome is the leading cause of death among babies between the ages of 1 month and 1 year, something common but most likely overlooked during its victim's normal development period is clearly to blame. And this common thing appears to be routine childhood vaccinations. A team of independent researchers looked at the infant mortality rate around the world and observed a direct relationship between the number of vaccines given and the number of infant deaths. In other words, countries that administer the most vaccines to children during the first year of life were found to have a higher infant mortality rate, while countries that were more careful with vaccines were found to have a lower infant mortality rate. Quote from the study, linear regression analysis of unweighed means infant mortality rates showed a high statistically significant correlation between increasing number of vaccine doses and increasing infant mortality rates, end quote. And that was also on the National Institutes of Health government website. Interestingly enough, the sudden infant death syndrome study also revealed that the hippocampus abnormalities associated with sudden infant death syndrome tend to emerge right around the time that babies are vaccinated for hepatitis B. And as you may recall, the hepatitis B vaccine is associated with causing seizures and epilepsy in some children, which is often associated with hippocampus abnormalities. This suggests that, at least in some cases, children who are vaccinated for hepatitis B immediately after birth, in accordance with U.S. Center for Disease Control Prevention guidelines, experience developmental damage to their hippocampus, which later leads to sudden death. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. In a moment, we're going to take an in-depth look from a very important perspective of consumerism, how we got there, how it manifests, and how it impacts all of us, and hopefully that we can learn from this. Also, I want to mention that today we can take no more reservations for tonight's premiere, but for any other night, or any other screening after today, and we have screenings for the next 7 days, which is a fundraiser for WBAI, you can call us, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. I look forward to seeing you all tonight. I'll be there after the 7:15 showing. It's a powerful film. The New York Times reviewed it today, and I thought they would just hate the film. It just depressed them. Gee whiz. Wonder why they should be depressed. Oh, I forgot. They didn't think Ralph Nader was good enough to run for president. We wouldn't have this depression in the reporter for the New York Times, nor would we have a 99.1% had we elected Ralph Nader. But I'll deal with that on tonight.
Many big ideas have struggled over the centuries to dominate the planet. Fascism. Communism. Democracy. Religion. But only one has achieved total supremacy. Its compulsive attractions rob its followers of reason and good sense. It has created unsustainable inequalities that threaten to tear apart the very fabric of our society.
More powerful than any cause or even religion, it has reached into every corner of the globe. It is consumerism. My name's Jonathan Porritt, and for the last 3 decades I've been banging on about the environment, about social justice, all that kind of stuff. I first got involved back in the 70s with Friends of the Earth and the Green Party. And since then I've been a campaigner, a candidate, I've taken direct action, I've been an advisor to government, to big business, I've written books, I've lectured, I've hectored, I've implored, deplored, you name it, I've done it. For the last 10 years, I've been working with Forum for the Future to promote the solutions to today's social and environmental problems. And I've come to realize that it's consumerism that is absolutely at the heart of this.
But what is consumerism? Isn't it just a posh way to describe shopping? We're all consumers, after all. We all go shopping. And society obviously couldn't function without some level of consumption.
I'm not talking about consumption here. I'm talking about the idea that we should all actively be consuming more and more every year, and that this is the best measure of economic progress. So consumerism puts consumption at the very heart of the modern economy, and everything is done to persuade us to go and consume more. Advertising hoardings, billboards, newspapers, magazines, the TV, we are bombarded day in, day out by these advertising messages. You may think they're all selling you something different, different products, different brands, different lifestyles, but at the same time, they're selling one big idea, that the more we consume, the better our lives will be.
Almost unnoticed, consumerism has become our principal pastime, our zeitgeist, our ideology, all rolled into one. It's a very seductive idea. But it's also a lethal idea. We've become a generation of compulsive shopaholics. Scale up all those individual acts of consumption, multiplied by several billion people, and stand back and watch the disaster unfold.
The trouble is, as consumers, we don't always know the real cost of what we're buying. Now, my daughters have an absolute passion for these Braben apples. They're juicy, crunchy, but they're air freighted in from New Zealand. So God knows how much fuel has been spent to get them here into my hometown. What we really ought to be doing is buying far more of the food that we need from local farmers' markets like this. That way, producers linked up with the consumer, environmental impacts are reduced, and we really do begin to understand the true cost of eating the way we eat today.
He It may seem ridiculous to link apples from New Zealand to global meltdown, but every little act of consumption is linked to a much bigger picture. Our love of shopping quite literally threatens the end of the world as we know it today. As our population grows and we go on consuming more and more, the ecosystems on which we depend are now close to collapse. Greenhouse gases are higher now than at any time in at least the past 650,000 years. The ice caps are melting. Glaciers are disappearing. Sea levels are rising. It's no longer a debate about if it's happening, but about how quickly and with what impact on our lives. No one will be immune from its effects. And it's all down to the power of modern consumerism. So how did we fall into this trap? For much of human history, the biggest problem was scarcity, experienced as poverty, hunger, deprivation. So this urge to acquire, to go beyond meeting one's basic needs, started as a survival instinct, as part of our essential human nature. As civilization advanced, life got easier. Material goods became more available. But they were never what we consider plentiful, except for a tiny minority. For thousands of years, there were only a comparatively few conspicuous consumers, the rich and the powerful. For them, the trappings of luxury always had a secondary purpose. They were designed to distinguish the rulers from the ruled, to remind the powerless where the power really lay. Society was so rigidly divided that the poor accepted their lot without question, and that was largely due to one very good reason. The fear of God. Most major faiths have historically stressed the importance of the community over the individual, a spiritual virtue over material success. The Quran, for example, encourages Muslims to focus on the spiritual rather than the physical world. Everything that is given to you is only the material of this life and its vanity. What is with God is far better and everlasting. The founding fathers of the Christian Church railed against material consumption too. As the Bible itself says, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Believers today still struggle to follow this teaching. But in the past, when religion was the force in the West, it set the tone for society.
It was the power of the church that reinforced people's willingness to be satisfied with very little. Frugality, not self-interest, was the name of the game. After all, what really mattered was life after death, not a better life here on Earth.
But after thousands of years, when wealth and material abundance were either unattainable or frowned upon, everything was about to change. During the 17th century, new trade routes opened up, and a new middle class of traders and entrepreneurs emerged to exploit them. They reveled in their newfound wealth. It now became respectable to consume and to flaunt one's consumption. In 1776, one man would capture this spirit of self-interested individualism. In his book, The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith argued that the pursuit of luxury worked as an economic driver that would make everybody richer. The best way to encourage economic growth is to unleash individuals to pursue their own selfish economic interests, he wrote. Adam Smith provided the model for an economic system which would take over the world. Capitalism was born. And from now on, consumerism would be at the heart of it. During the 19th century, scarcity was gradually overcome. Personal wealth and the trade it promoted drove an unparalleled economic boom that transformed the West. Giant factories were built to provide the goods that society now demanded.
Thanks to the Industrial Revolution, there was a gradual shift towards mass consumerism. Mountains of manufactured goods began to appear, cheap stuff that more and more people could afford. And it felt good, as if the better life was just around the corner.
And it wasn't just the production of goods which was revolutionized. The process of buying was itself transformed. After the first department store opened in 1852, shopping became a respectable leisure activity. Department stores offered a dream world of material. Department stores offered a dream world of material luxury, promoting shopping as an experience to savor. And stores became the cathedrals for a new faith on the march. But there was one country in which shopping and consumerism would become a way of life. By the early 20th century, Americans had the highest personal wealth of any country in the world, creating huge new markets. Enterprising business people realized that they could make their fortunes by manufacturing luxury items at prices the American working classes could afford. Henry Ford's assembly line made cars which were previously the preserve of just a privileged few available to all. Many other products were soon to follow. By the 1920s, the ordinary man and woman in America had come to believe that affluence was their birthright. And to have access to consumer wealth became an integral part of the American dream.
It was around this time that consumerism took a very different turn, stimulating and manipulating people's desires, spinning dreams, subtly creating envy. And as the advertising industry really took off, temptation and seduction became at least as important as providing information.
Big business and its advertising agencies turned to the science of psychology. One of the pioneers was Edward Bernays, who had become known as the father of public relations. He was fascinated by the discoveries of Freud and other psychiatrists. He believed that if you understood what motivated people, you could influence their behavior without them knowing about it and cajole them into buying even more. He said, "In almost every act of our daily lives, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind." Advertisers started to work out how to play on our subconscious. It wasn't what the product did that mattered. It was the kind of person it promised to make you feel. Consumerism was now deep inside our heads, exploiting our deepest feelings, our emotions, and even our identities. We were all being trained to desire. But consumerism didn't always go unopposed. Most famously, in the 1960s, the hippie movement rebelled against rampant capitalism. It transformed this disgust with materialism not just into a philosophy, but into a new way of living too. Millions attempted to drop out. It was a movement that had enormous appeal. This was pretty much the point when I first got involved, as the environment and social justice grabbed my attention and suppressed whatever shopping gene I may once have had. It all started in a comprehensive in West London, where I spent 10 years of my life teaching English and drama.
I wasn't exactly an out-and-out hippie, but even then I can remember the kids constantly taking the piss out of me for choosing to own a bicycle rather than a car, for never buying new clothes until I absolutely had to because the old ones were falling to pieces. To them, I just wasn't doing my duty as a consumer. So even in the 70s, the juggernaut of consumerism was grinding into top gear. And trashing the environment was almost universally accepted as a reasonable price to pay for all that increased consumption.
However, by the end of the 1970s, the environmentalist message was beginning to be taken seriously. Organizations like Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth, of which I was then the director, captured the headlines. But then, America and the West took a fateful step. A new breed of politicians dismissed environmental warnings and ushered in an age of even more rampant materialism. Hippies were now replaced by yuppies, and a new philosophy ruled. Greed is good. Throughout the 80s, we were all encouraged to measure our success by how much we earned and how much we bought. And today's successors to Thatcher and Reagan have done little to set aside the toxic legacy of such triumphalist individualism. Such is the momentum of consumerism that nothing has been able to slow its relentless march. After 9/11, with America shaken to its core, President Bush told the nation to demonstrate they were unbowed by this assault on the American way of life by going shopping.
We cannot let the terrorists achieve the objective of frightening our nation to the point where we don't conduct business, where people don't shop.
You can see what the president meant. Behaving normally was the best response. And normality in today's economy means being out there shopping.
Nothing, not even international terrorism, would be allowed to stand between the people and their pursuit of the great American dream.
The irony is that the biggest threat to the United States and to the rest of the world isn't terrorism. It's consumerism itself. We've unleashed so powerful a force that our politicians simply don't know how to get this particular genie back into its bottle. But there are practical solutions, if we have the courage to act on them now. It is now almost 250 years since the philosopher Adam Smith told us that the pursuit of wealth was not just good for the individual, but good for society too. We are all beneficiaries of that extraordinary transformation. Today we are all spoiled for choice, as long as you can afford it. And globalization means that the hamburger you buy in China will taste the same as the one you buy in the United States. Consumerism has become the global language that everyone understands.
At the beginning of the 21st century, there are now more than 2 billion people able to enjoy the fruits of mass consumption. Whichever way you cut it, that's an extraordinary achievement. You just can't deny that represents progress with a capital P.
But at long last, we're beginning to realize just how high a price we're having to pay for this. Visit any old landfill site and you'll begin to see what I mean. Here in Britain, we get rid of our own body weight in rubbish every 7 weeks. And the amount of rubbish we throw away just keeps growing. There are 12,000 landfill sites in the UK alone dedicated to dealing with the 100 million tonnes of waste we produce each year.
Buy it one day, chuck it the next. In our throwaway world, who cares?
We throw out 1.5 million computers every year, 99% of them in perfect working order. On average, we buy a new mobile phone every 18 months, leaving 90 million working handsets hoarded in cupboards up and down the country. And 3 million fridges are discarded every year. Every year we buy more products, more things we think we need, using more energy, creating more waste. It's this seemingly inexorable process which is now threatening life on Earth.
So, am I being overdramatic? Well, just look at the evidence. What were once the dodgy projections of so-called extremists like myself on waste, energy, water, and so on, are now the hard-edged scientific data of government research departments.
And the data's getting more frightening by the day. Across the world, more and more countries are following in our polluted tracks. China's economy has grown at around 10% every year for the last 15 years. The result has been an explosion in consumption. Around 250 million people now enjoy a relatively affluent lifestyle, roughly the same number as the entire population of the United States. Consumerism in the Western world took two centuries to develop. In China, it's taking less than a decade. This may be great news for a country emerging from centuries of poverty, but it comes at a serious cost. China is planning to build 10 new airports and roughly 35 new coal-fired power stations every year for the next 5 years. Car sales have also increased dramatically. There are now 1,000 new cars on Beijing's roads every single day. By 2015, there will be more cars in China than in the whole of the United States. So if China ever achieved the same level of car ownership as the United States, with its much bigger population, they would need to import more oil every day than is produced in the entire world every year.
This is what I call impossibilism, because it literally can't be done. It just isn't possible to extend the American dream into every single corner of the planet. It won't work.
If all 6 billion people here on Earth were to consume at the same level as we ourselves do here in the UK, we would need two more planets to provide all the necessary energy, soil, water, raw materials to make that possible. But it's not just the planet we're damaging. Western multinationals are competing ferociously with each other to keep their consumers happy with ever lower prices. And producers in developing countries are suffering as a result. Sweatshops, child labor, dangerous working conditions, scandalously low wages. The bottom end of the global market is a grim and degrading place for millions of people. But the irony is that even in the rich world, consumerism blights millions of lives too. Research has shown that once our incomes rise above a certain level, happiness has very little to do with the size of our bank balance.
There's a simple reason for this. Happiness is not a question of absolute wealth, it's a question of relative wealth. In other words, how wealthy are you relative to other people? These days, just getting richer isn't the point. You've got to be better off than your neighbours, better off than your work colleagues, better off than all those people you read about or see on the telly.
So this relentless pressure to earn more and buy more is ultimately self-defeating. What most of us crave is to feel safe and secure, to feel connected to others, to be part of a community, to feel good about our real selves, not just about our image. But consumerism cannot meet those needs. people who are driven predominantly by material goals, by money, status, in-your-face affluence, are likely to enjoy life less than those driven by goals such as good relationships, satisfying work, real quality of life. So what can we do about this?
Consumer-driven capitalism, in all its brute force, is the only economic show in town. There's no political alternative around the corner to replace it, for the foreseeable future at least. So we have to make consumerism work better. Better for us, better for other people, better for the planet. And we don't have much time to do that.
Consumerism can be redirected, and it's happening already. Let's start with what individuals can do. For one thing, it is possible to opt for a different work-life balance. Thousands of people every year are escaping the rat race by downshifting, to spend more time with families and friends. They're trading in a higher income for a higher quality of life. And even if we can't do that for personal or financial reasons, we can live our present lifestyles more ethically.
We can all learn to consume more responsibly as individuals, taking the train, for instance, when possible, instead of the car. But even with the best of intentions, we often find ourselves trapped in unsustainable lifestyles, having to commute in and out of towns and cities to afford somewhere to live, unable to avoid all that wasteful packaging in supermarkets. We're all going to have to try just a bit harder.
The really good news is that the technologies already exist to enable us to radically change our individual lifestyles and become more environmentally friendly. The problem is persuading people to make use of them. So I'm on my way to Sutton in Surrey to visit the UK's first and still best known sustainable housing project. Bedzed, the Beddington Zero Energy Development, is sited on reclaimed land. Built 5 years ago, it's designed to show that eco-construction and a green lifestyle can provide a good quality of life and be affordable too. Building materials come from local, renewable or recycled sources. Energy efficiency is an absolute priority. Heat and electricity are fueled by tree waste, and each house has solar panels and triple glazing. Rainwater is recycled. Domestic appliances are water efficient and low energy. And there's a car share scheme that residents really do make use of. Puran Desai co-founded Bedzed and has lived here from the start.
We all had to work incredibly hard to get this project off the ground. And here, you know, we're going quite a long way to creating what is a vision for a one planet living community. I think within 2, 3, 4, 5 years, you know, we will see very energy efficient homes fitted with energy efficient appliances, many more with some level of integrated renewable energy generation, whether that's solar panels or hot water, solar hot water panels or wood heating systems, or even perhaps some wind turbines on the roof. So, you know, we will see many more of them being incorporated. But we also got to remember that actually, you know, it is our whole lifestyle that counts. And for instance, if you live here and take one overseas, you know, trip to Australia, one flight to Australia, it's as much as 8 years of carbon savings here. You know,
one return flight to Australia.
Yeah,
bloody
that
hell.
Sort of figure.
Sorry. Even I'm a bit surprised by that.
Yeah, so you start getting the scale of the issues. So, we have to think about our whole lifestyles. We can't just think about energy-efficient homes or, you know, sustainable food or increasing recycling. We have to think of it in a much more holistic way.
Yeah.
4 or 5 years ago, Bedzed was a real pioneer, and it's still very inspirational today. There hasn't been a lot of progress since then, however, not many new developments of this kind. But things are now beginning to change. With rising energy prices, growing awareness about climate change, people have got the message.
Good.
The truth is, however, that
people do have the message more and more. That is the UK Channel 5's Trap of Materialism, And I felt that it was important to understand how we got into the problem so that those who are seeking a more minimalist, holistic, integrated life can have a context to make their changes. I'll be doing more on how to get off the grid on upcoming programs. We're at the end of our program. I want to thank you all for taking your time. If you want to be a part of Poverty Inc., which this also is a part of, in other words, we're dealing with the people who enslave us by making us believe that we need what they have and we don't. Call for your reservations, not for today, we're full for today, but for the other showings this week. I'll be there every night at 7:30. 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. Thank you very much. Look forward to seeing many of you tonight at the screening. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Just to tack on to this whole subject that you're talking about today, a couple of your listeners have emailed me information about other things that we do to destroy our environment and to destroy our economies. And one of them is an article about in Peru, decades of illegal gold mining transformed large expanses of virgin Peruvian rainforest into pocked, denuded, mercury-poisoned wastelands. Now, there is an entire ecosystem that is now gone. Birds, insects, animals, resources, absolutely gone. Oxygen for our environment, gone. And also, another article that was sent to me from one of the listeners is coming from giraffes are becoming extinct because of poachers. Again, because we sell, I don't know what we're selling on giraffes, but giraffes are now becoming extinct in Africa. This is very, very sad to see this mindset proliferating, not just in the United States, but all over the world. I wonder
there is a solution to this, and I thought about this. Because I have been involved in animal rescue my entire adult life. In fact, I intend in the new year to set up an animal rescue of all types of animals, hoof stock, exotics. And for those who want to participate, who want to do something different in life, they can be a part of it. Give them a different type of lifestyle. But that's something I'll do after the first of the year. In any case, I believe that the only thing that could be done is take the most respected and the most legitimate of the animal preserve and conservation foundations and put all the energy into going to every country in Africa, let's start with Africa, and having all of the animals that are going extinct brought into one country, into one preserve, and then have the human power there that are paid to protect the animals. And when you have individuals in preserves protecting the animals, those animals are rarely poached. It is when you have these large savannas and you have no one protecting them that the rhinos, they get killed for their horns, the elephants for their tusks, tigers for their testicles, in which case you have a preserve that's large enough, probably hundreds of thousands of acres, where they can live as they normally would, but they would live in safety because you would have everything there for them. Now, I'm only referring to those animals that are endangered. In some of those animals, you only have hundreds left. The most you have are thousands left. And you have to select a country that's willing to work with you, that does not have the corruption that allows this to go on, because like in Peru or in Brazil, I've seen Brazil. I've flown over the rainforest of almost every country in South America. It is not humanly possible to have the destruction of the environment without full, complicit cooperation of the land barons and the administrative officials overseeing the different areas, the governors of their areas. They're all corrupt. They all have something that they get for this occurring. And so you have to have a place where the officials are not going to be corrupted, and that's where you bring all the animals. And within 2 years of doing this, where there's one place to protect them in one habitat that would be suited for all types of species that have enough land so that they're not encroaching upon one another but are compatible within an area, then that would work. And I think the whole world would support that. That's my solution.
Sounds good.
Okay, and I know the retreat's full, so that's good. And we're full for the screening tonight, and that's good. So I look forward to seeing people tonight and tomorrow and the next night for the next 7 nights. So thank you all for listening, and let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hi, Gary. Today it's Free Your Mind Fire Day on Lead Stories, and listeners have their say.
We look forward to it right now, Utrice Lead.